Namaste, good morning, everyone. I would like to today read out two passages very pertinent to the teaching, the understanding of it, and its direct impact in daily living. The first is from the words of Joel Goldsmith. Sorry. Our prayer is a peace be still, a silent communion, even unto that storm at sea. The Master never prayed that it be dispelled. His only prayer was, be still. Was he addressing the water? No. He was addressing his consciousness and the consciousness of his disciples. Peace, be still. If our consciousness is still, there are no stormy waters within or without. If our consciousness is still, everything about us takes on the complexion of that stillness. You see, so this is about the stillness within, not about trying to change the without. In other words, the attitude to life. That is where the change is brought about by the teaching, by the grace of the teaching. In quietness and in stillness shall be our strength. Not in speech. Speech is our human way of interpreting divine ideas. But the divine ideas express and manifest themselves within us without words. We put the finger on the lips, are still, and receive an assurance that God is on the field. That the battle is not ours, but God's. You see, that is the point which needs to be emphasized. The personal battles we have been fighting with people, with events in our lives, situations, and with ourselves. With this teaching, we lay down our sword. This constant conflict with what is starts dropping away. This egoic need to fight what is in front of us. Because then the ego knows this is who I am. I am the one fighting the circumstance, and so now I know who I am. Without its sword, the ego is disarmed. So we find that our life, our daily living, becomes more and more attuned to peace and harmony. Old dramas may play up, and even those are seen in the light of this understanding that this is how the ego is operating. The ego, with its sense of doership, either pinned onto others or onto oneself. You see, it is in the light of wisdom, divine wisdom, that the ego gets exposed, the antics of the ego get exposed. And it is seen that it is the ego which is trying to survive and win the battles in life. This is witnessed. The ego comes up strongest when it is threatened the most, when its survival is threatened. And when Joel Goldsmith refers to speech, what he is pointing to is the fact that our speech is largely determined by our conditioning. For example, we have been taught the alphabets and words as children. That is itself conditioning, the beginnings of speech, you see. Then we have been shaped by our peers, our parents, our school teachers, the people we look up to when we are young, the school captain, and so on and so forth. And all this becomes the conditioning of speech. When speech is suspended, in that sense, conditioning is suspended. Of course, there is the internal conditioning of the thoughts going round and round in one's mind. But that is what Joel Goldsmith is pointing to, that the peace be still is prior to speech. And if you do find that as a result of following not only this teaching, any master, you find that you are becoming quieter within and perhaps even without in terms of speaking less, there's nothing wrong with you. Some people tell me that they are now being considered unfriendly because they don't speak like they used to with their friends. They speak less. They are more available just like that. And that compulsive need is not there. And so the friends say, why are you not talking? Why have you changed? This teaching is not suiting you. The ego cannot fathom that without constant talking, two people can be together. It's an aberration. I was shown a comment below one of these videos which are uploaded on YouTube. Are the silent parts really necessary? Firstly, the silent parts are not deliberate. They are not a doing. When something is not meant to come out, it does not come out. It is not planned. And this also shows how the ego is not comfortable with silence. The ego will not like being told that. If the polaric opposite of silence is speech, why not embrace both? Speech is happening sometimes. Silence is happening sometimes. Without any doing, that is the whole point. The other thing I would like to read out is an engaging conversation between a disciple of the Sufi mystic called affectionately as Bhai Sahib and his called Irina Tweedy, sorry, the disciple's name, and Bhai Sahib, her guru. Again, very pertinent to this teaching. And that is why I like this practical approach which everyone can relate to in their own experience. That is the simplicity of these Advaita teachings. So this is like a narration which is going on, where she is speaking first and her thoughts, etc. And then we come to what Bhai Sahib says. So she says, "This morning the police inspector was already sitting when I came. He was very fat and I think very ignorant. Again and again he was repeating that one should remember God all the time, and how he wished to be like me, because he has seen that I have renounced the world. At first I was bored, but then his urgency struck me. Why this fear in him? Why the constant self-accusations? I looked at him with attention, and the truth dawned on me. He will not live very long. A few more years probably, and his soul, his Atman, who tries to impress the personality with the urgency to think of God, is what is making him speak. I felt sorry for him and began to watch the Guru. The Guru began to talk to him as soon as he came out, with such love, such affection, explaining to him proverbs, telling stories. When he was looking at this man, his expression was so full of love. There was something in his face, something I know from other planes, beyond the comprehension of the mind. A flaming face of such infinite love." Then Bhai Sahib says, "Deceive, do all sorts of evils if you cannot help it. Burn all the sacred books, but never, never, never hurt anybody's feelings. He was translating this from a Sufi doctrine. It seems to hurt the feelings of others must be the greatest crime. Truly, it is said in Light on the Path, if you can speak in the presence of your master, your tongue must have lost its power to wound." You see, this is a very important point. To never, never hurt anyone deliberately. If one accepted that nobody was the doer of the actions, in other words, if one saw God in the other, then that sensitivity, that knowing that the other is an instrument of God just as I am, shaped by the sufferings of life, all the pains, perhaps different from what I have faced, but still shaped by all that, then what naturally arises is, you can say, being nice, being gentle, being kind, being warm. And respecting the other's point of view. So this, the drive of the ego to push a point home to speak one's mind, one's opinion, one's views, one's judgments. That drive goes. This almost automatic response the ego has to trample over others' views, others' opinions, and so on. And so someone asked me, but if I hurt somebody else, it's God's will. Of course it is God's will. But that is, if the intention was not there to hurt, and it still happens, we cannot control, we may say something that is misconstrued and the other takes offense. It was not a deliberate attempt to hurt the other. And an apology can arise. Look, I didn't mean to. You seem to be hurt. I honestly didn't mean to. In such instances, if we say hurt was meant to happen, it's fine. But if our ego is still in the reactionary mode of he or she did this to me, and therefore I will do this to him, and then you say, oh, it's God's will. That is the ego that has come in through the back door. The thief is wearing the robes of the policeman. The arsonist is in charge of the fire engines, as Rameshji would say. So this ego can be quite wily and a colorful character, and says, oh, it's all God's will. If you truly lived from that center of being, where you honored the person in front of you as an equal representation of the divine, whom you may or may not agree with, you would still naturally, spontaneously, not say offensive words, because the doership within your own being has not been triggered. This is a very, very important point. This teaching is not a license to behave in any way one wishes to. To the extent that in this Sufi tradition, I might have mentioned this in earlier talks, that when even there was a remote possibility of hurting the person by speaking a truth, as far as the master is concerned, they would direct the conversation to someone else in the audience and give what is called a hint, in the hope that the person it is actually addressed to has the awareness to understand that the master is referring to him or her. That is the degree of sensitivity. Can you imagine that? Because the master knows that the ego may not like being told certain truths. So rather than having it take offense immediately, approach it from the side. That was their way. So I keep pointing to this one fact. Please make this teaching relatable to your daily living, your relationships. Don't get too lost into the concepts, because then that gives the mind a free rein to keep asking various kinds of questions. Like I received a mail on to explain Rinanubandhan and when did the first Rinanubandhan happen and so on and so forth. Rather ask in this life, my relationships, my Rinanubandhan, what holds it together and how can it be freed? This bondage of relationships where we accuse each other, we trigger each other, we frustrate each other, how can one be free of that? Of that bandhan? And the answer is so simple, it's already given. Your relationship with others is your relationship with God. Without this imposition of doership on a relationship, the relationship is free. This does not mean you part ways physically. Oh, I don't want to see this person anymore in my life. That may be so, but that is not the meaning of the bondage getting over. Has it been processed within? Have you within dropped all accusations aimed at the other? That is when this bondage ends. All right. If anyone would like to share anything or ask a question, you are welcome to do so now. I must apologize. On the Thursday silent meditations we have, I said the same thing at the end of the meditation, that if anyone had a question related to the meditation, they should ask it. And then I forgot to open the window to see if anyone had their hands raised. And so I thought no one had anything to share. And later on, I was informed that a couple of people had wanted to ask. But you see, that's what happens with meditation. The mind becomes a bit vacant. So apologies for that. Yes, Ramanathan.
Thank you, Gautamji.
Hello.
Yeah. Before I ask you a question, I just want to, something popped up when I saw you 3 weeks back, and I was not able to share. I've been containing myself from sharing it. I just want to say, I think when George Bernard Shaw met Jiri Krishnamurti, he actually said, "You are the most beautiful man on earth." I want to say the same thing to you.
Oh, I've never seen very this. Sweet of you. It's so kind.
So after Jiddu Krishnamurti, I don't think I've seen anyone as so peaceful and handsome like you. Thanks for that. And been reflecting on the teachings. I've been steeped on Sri Ramana Maharishi's teachings and Mr. Nisargadatta Maharaj and Swami Ramdas' teachings. The question that I have, if you don't mind, Gautamji, is that one of the sages of India, Dr. Pai, used to say, part-time sadhus never get enlightened. Right? It is the intensity of the practice that really matters. For example, I am a grihastha, as we said, because you're married, you have child, a kid, right? The associated responsibilities are always there. But once you know this is a dream, that ego is just dreaming, and the point is to wake up, right? And how does one balance this, right? Can someone be a part-time sadhu and also seek an enlightenment, right? How do I wake up if I'm always engaged in samsaric life? Thank you.
Yes, Ramanathan, we are full-time sadhus. Being grihastha, I am a householder like you. I don't have children, I'm married. But we are the full-time sadhus because we have to deal with relationships. It's easy to go and sit in a cave. But the point is, the main point is, are we throughout the day, not just as a practice, contemplating on, reflecting on the teaching, seeing things from this point of view, looking at our relationships in light of the teaching? That is what makes us full-time sadhus, and not as just a temporary practice of 1 hour in the morning or something. That is the beauty of it. And Ramana Maharshi himself has said, in fact, if you have read enough of Bhagwan, he was pretty much against people in the ochre robes. You see, because in daily living, in life, the teaching has to bloom and flower. And so life gives you so many opportunities in your day, in a city, in your job, at home, in relationships with your friends, so many opportunities are given for the teaching to expose itself. So I think, I honestly feel that to be in the world and not of it is where the teaching comes in the strongest. And you are quite right. The result, you see, Ramanathan, that's actually something quite beautiful you said. That's the dream of life. When we see that life is pleasure sometimes, pain sometimes, everything is transient, everything is fleeting. What really mattered yesterday no longer matters today. Then this quality of daily living becomes like a dream. The living dream of life. That's not a bad thing. Where did it go, you wonder? And so this, the reality with the lower R, which we were attributing to events and things that happened to me, that becomes hazy. Because the reality with the capital R is what shines through in daily living. That is the beauty of it. So this, I'm very honestly, I feel that for all of us here who are not sitting in caves or don't have the opportunity or the capacity to be in an ashram environment 24/7, daily living is our ashram. Daily living is our meditation. And what happens in daily living? Does that answer your question in some way?
Absolutely, Gautamji. That's why we call Grahastha, each is the four ashrams. Absolutely. I think somewhere Jiddu Krishnamurti had told that at the age of 45, give up everything, leave up all the sensate once you know it's a dream, and then just work hard to find out what the truth is, what the reality is. Fortunately, I don't have God's grace. I don't have any conflicts with my domestic life or samsaric life. My point was that if you like something, it becomes samsaric. If you want to wake up, you have to break stones in like in a prison, sit in a prison and break stones. That's the way one gets liberated. That's the point I was trying to, seeking your guidance on that. That's what. Thank you.
Yes, but to be honest, I don't think we have to break stones in prison because life itself is our prison. We have been imprisoned. As Rameshji would say, the whole point is whether we convert our simple imprisonment into rigorous imprisonment. And how do we do that? When we blame and condemn and hate people, we are converting the simple imprisonment of life into rigorous imprisonment. Now, in the imprisonment of life, to further imprison ourselves in a prison and break stones is a lot of pain and suffering. Enjoy life. Enjoy the ups and downs. You have been given a fixed number of breaths, as it is said in our scriptures. Everyone's time is marked. The point is, are we going to pass that time in peace or in conflict? Are we going to embrace others for who they are and not whom we want them to be? Or are we going to keep asserting our point of view and how we feel others should be? So that is why Rameshji would say in very simple terms that the purpose of life is the living of it. The purpose of life is the living of it. Or the purpose of life is to let life flow. And that will happen only when there's an awakening to the truth. So at the higher level, so to speak, we say the purpose of life is self-realization, as Bhagwan would say, why we have been given the human birth. But let us not make this arduous for ourselves, Ramanathan, because life is pretty hard on us already. Let's try our best to not only enjoy the process, but be a beacon of peace to the lives we touch. All right. Anything else, Ramanathan?
No, thank you. Thanks for that. Thank you.
Yes, Himanshu.
So my question is, in my outer relationships, I see people who talk about Advaita, about peace in daily living, but in some ways I see that the instrument is still not purified, and in one way they have this tamasic acceptance of the patterns of their life, and sometimes I am not sure if I should really try to point it out to them, because even I feel bad at times, and they tend to become, they are trying their best, but it is not happening. So where does that understanding come? What is meant to happen will happen, but where do I stop myself from?
You see, Himanshu, you have to start and stop with yourself and forget others. Because even if others are not living the teaching, though they say they are, that is their destiny and God's will. And also that is your perspective of it. Someone else in their lives may feel that they are the epitome of living the Advaita teachings. We are concerned with ourselves only. We are not placed here to give advice unless we are asked for it. So why not focus on one's own journey, one's own peace of mind? Let others be left to their devices. Look at your daily living. Look at your peace of mind. Whether you are saying one thing and talking about Advaita, or is it purely being lived? And do not judge if that's not happening, because even that is meant to be. Sometimes the understanding is only intellectual. Then it goes down slowly, slowly, slowly. Sometimes it goes down fast. Everyone is on their own journey. Be concerned with yours. Then all the problems are over. Or perhaps then they've really begun. You see? Fundamentally, Himanshu, our relationship with others is our relationship with ourselves. That is something we tend to forget. Does this answer your question?
Yes, it does.
You have a nice, colorful, geometric background.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Binoy.
Yes, hi, sir.
Hello.
So, I would like to talk about an incident that happened.
Can you speak a bit louder, please?
Sorry, yes. Yes, I would like to talk about an incident that happened like a year ago. So I have always been attracted to Nisargadatta Maharaj's teaching. And one day I was reading his book at the lake, and I was fortunate to have a perception of truth. And now there is no need for like reading even the great statements, like all there is godliness has lost its meaning. So I wanted to ask if like people are young and if they had their awakening, how are they interested in getting married? Because I have no desire for getting married or any other desires or fears.
Well, Binoy, the first point is, like you say, reading has stopped, there is no need and there are no desires. Are you at peace?
Yes, I am.
So if your answer is yes, if there is no desire to get married, don't get married.
Right.
As simple as that.
Yeah, I'm absolutely happy and peaceful. And I'm okay with like not getting married. But how do you explain your family? Because my family is like really fanatic about their religion, and they can only understand if I have like shaved head or yellow. I mean,
why? Yes, that is tough. I can fully understand that, because especially in the Indian context, and that to certain communities, there's this hardwired conditioning of marriage. But it's also a very modern age. And you see, if you are able to stand your ground and express yourself, you must.
Right.
That's my view. I mean, I'm not trying to make you a rebel or anything like that. But if you have the kind of clarity you have, I don't think it's fair for anyone else to take ownership of that.
Sure.
These are, of course, my views. And if your parents take offense at that, then I'm sorry. But let's just keep marriage aside for now. And what I would like to ask you, Binoy, is in daily living, do you have peace and harmony, not only with relationships, with your friends, with your family, with events that happen in your life? How do you see your day or your week going by?
It's absolutely amazing. Like, I have no conflicts whatsoever. I was in USA for 5 years, and because of COVID, like, there was a travel ban and my visa got canceled, and everyone in the family was like worrying about me, but I had no problems with that. I was like, fine, I will live here. It doesn't matter to me. So there's no conflict unless like they keep mentioning marriage all day. Anything but that, it's fine.
Well, if you were Sufi, you could say I'm married to God. Or Bhakt. But what do you do, Binoy, in life?
I'm a design engineer. So.
So you have a job?
I had a job, but I will be looking for a new job since I'm here in India right now.
Okay, but your day is you're engaged in work.
Yes.
So the working mind is engaged, and when the working mind is not engaged, you find yourself generally to be at peace and harmony with daily living.
Right. You just don't have as many like need for indulgence. Like, you don't feel like I should be lazy or I should keep watching TV or like all the other activities like drinking alcohol or going after women all the time. All these activities doesn't interest you.
So how do you pass your time, Binoy, if I may ask?
Yes, just like whatever I feel, depending. Like, I can, sometimes I enjoy Kabir's songs. That's one of my most favorite activities, because it's like
Kabir's songs.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Listening to Sufi song or like Kabir's song and reading for like hour or so if I feel like it, but I'm not reading as much as I was.
Right.
So working from 9 to 5 right now, I was preparing for like IELTS exams. So there's that. And then watching stand-up comedies. I enjoy that too.
And how old are you?
I'm 27.
Okay. I met someone who was recently, a week ago, who's 23 and in pretty much the same space as you. Only difference is he's married. But, you know, pretty much no desires and at peace with what is. And it's actually a gift, if you ask me, Binoy, because it reminds me of the time when my guru was in the hospital. And he was in his 80s at that time. And the doctor who was tending to him was 55 or 56. And Rameshji had this habit of gifting his books. So he gave it to the ward boys. He gave it to the nurses and he gave it to the doctors. And this doctor who was tending to him said, I don't need this book. So my teacher was quite taken aback. I mean, it was a gift. He said, I'm too young for all this. When I'm old and retired, only then I'll start reading it. And you see, when one is exposed to all these teachings, in your case, you came across Nisargadatta Maharaj's words. at a young age, it really sets you up to deal with what challenges and whatever life may bring your way. And it's such a gift to have this backing, this perspective, which was a happening by the grace of God. After all, you didn't choose to read that excerpt from Maharaj's book. So when, at a young age, it is a tremendous, tremendous benefit to see life, to live life, to see the dualities of life through the place, from the place where you have reached. And even when it comes to marriage, I'd like to add here, you see, with this teaching, the whole perspective of dialogue changes because you are no longer in opposition with your parents. You sit them down, you understand they are talking based on their conditioning, their worldview. So that is accepted. You tell them, I accept. I'm not trying to say you are wrong and right. I accept that this is what you feel. And this is what I feel based on my condition. So when this opposition, this force of me versus the other is changed to me and the other, the outcome sometimes changes. Sometimes it may not. And that is why my teacher, when he was the bank manager, and it's something even I practiced actually in my business, when there was an important meeting, he would get up from his chair and come and sit alongside his client. Because the desk created the me versus the other, and side by side, ordering a cup of chai and talking makes it so much more pleasant.
Right.
So that is what happens, right?
Yes.
Okay, Binod, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, Ram Kumar.
Pranam, your talks are always good. I wanted to really ask one thing. We say God's will and God's grace, but if we see, I think that both are really same. When something happens according to our choice, after efforts, we say it's God's grace. And sometimes when, despite all our efforts, something which we do not want to happen happens, then we say God's will. But God is not dualistic, right? It is only one consciousness.
Yes.
We say it only for our own sake, right? Will and grace.
It's the same thing. What is the difference?
Okay. So there is no really difference.
What exactly are you asking?
Yeah, there is no difference, right? We only say it for sake that it is God's grace, God's will. They both are one and the same.
And even our will is God's will. Even they are one and the same.
Yes.
You see, the only difference, the only slight difference is this attribute of doership, which makes us feel that it is our will, my will as against God's will. It's only that slight offset, Ram Kumar, which is corrected by the teaching.
Okay.
It is a slight offset, but becomes the biggest thing in life, you see, for most of us. But that is what it is. When we are in alignment with God's will, it doesn't mean our will against God's will. It means we have seen that our will and God's will is truly the same when the thorn of doership is removed from the equation. Okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I have one more question.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, sometimes I'm not able to discern whether if the voices in the head are that of the mischief mind or that from direct intuition. On some actions, just day-to-day some actions, I really don't get that during that time, whether those voices in the head are of the mischief mind or direct into.
It is that which doesn't get that which is the voice. It is the ego which doesn't know whether this is this voice, that is the voice, that is the ego. You see, what does it matter? In silence would this question come up? The confusion, Ram Kumar, is this a voice in my head? Is this actually this? That is itself the ego, which is analyzing and judging and measuring and comparing. It is that which quietens down. It's very important to understand this. Because when there is peace of mind, this does not arise. So when there is this confusion, then it is for you a moment to reflect on who is it that is confused about all this. And the answer will be the ego. All right. Anything else you'd like to ask, Ram Kumar?
No. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Priyam.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I have two questions. The first one is around money. Mm-hmm. How to overcome this seeming resistance to money. Like, for example, I paint all day, and once the bills are paid, the rent is paid, there is a seeming like discomfort in pricing the paintings. It seems to me a little bit coming from the space of ego. Like for me, personally, I don't want someone to sell me something because I'm very minimal. So I rarely buy something. So for me to sell my own creations is like a little bit challenging at times. It feels like, is it coming from a space of ego? How the intention always behind all the paintings is just to have some positivity in people's houses and to make their living spaces like a little bit better. It's always made with the intention of that warmth and that joy inside me wanting to express itself. So how to be more okay with pricing what I have to offer in the world? That is my first question. And my second question is, the way you delivered the teachings and everything, is there any plans like you have in the future to maybe also have them in Hindi? Because I personally know some people here in Rishikesh and some extended family who will benefit if you also have some way of having the talks in Hindi. So,
sure. So let's address the first question, which is most interesting. Can you tell me whether your livelihood depends on the selling of your paintings, or is it just a hobby?
No, professionally right now I am into painting, and when my paintings sell, that's how I pay my bills and everything. I was in fact painting, like I paint on my hands even right now. So that's what I do professionally.
So you are very fortunate, Priyam, that your paintings sell, because there are many artists who are struggling. You know, I remember near my home is the Jahangir Art Gallery, about a 10-minute walk away. And out inside the gallery, of course, are the big exhibitions and all. And outside are lined up the artists who are trying to make it big. So they are given a space, a wall is put up where they can hang their paintings and the passersby can look at them and interact with them and perhaps purchase them. So you are one of the fortunate few artists who are getting a good price for their paintings. And for this, of course, I'm sure gratitude arises. The point is the guilt. You see, the guilt that, am I charging too much? This is what I love to do, spread positivity, etc., and all that. It all depends, honestly, on what you do with that money, Priyam. How free are you with it? Not just you, anyone. You see, supposing I was an artist and I had an agent and he said, you know, I've seen what's in the market. I understand as a professional the pricing. And I would price you in XYZ bracket. Then I would hand over the reins to the agent and say, all right, you're the professional, I am not, and whatever it is, do it. And it still sells at those prices. Pleasure will arise. I will be happy. But without this doership that I am a good painter, I have been given skill sets, paintings have been produced, and people seem to value them based on a professional's advice. They are priced quite highly. People pay for them. So when you detach from the doing of the painting, everything is seen in the light of impersonality. Now, what is your relationship with money? how free are you with the money which comes in? When people pay you for your artwork because they value it, what is your equation with that? That will tell you whether you are at peace with the money. If you spend freely, if you see something you like and you purchase it spontaneously, whatever it may be. You see, the whole point is the ego, when it views money as, I am doing something, my God, I am doing it and people value it so much, I'm feeling guilty now. That is the voice of the ego. It's very important to see how the ego operates. And when you yourself purchase things, when you gift things, do you see that the same source which brought money towards you is sending money away from you to someone else? Then money is literally seen as a flow of energy and one is not controlling it. Like the ego loves to hoard, for example. Build reserves, build savings, protection for the future. So if you find this free flow with money, then you will be at peace with money. Then you will know that this is all in my mind, this guilt which I'm feeling. I don't deserve it. If that is what is happening for you, that is the ego in operation. Now, the flip side could be that one fine day you wake up and say, I don't need any more money and I'm going to paint for free. So be it. You see, what happens is we tend to judge ourselves all the time, which is what is happening. So that judgment has to be dropped. If you have to earn a living, God has given you art, so be it. If you didn't have to, Priyam, let's say you were the daughter of a rich businessman or whatever, at that point you might have yourself said, I'm painting for free, but it is all circumstantial. So the troublemaker is the ego which is feeling guilty. Does that help in any way to answer your...
Thank you, sir. And you're right about gratitude. I'm very grateful because I just quit my banking job just one day randomly without a plan. And I'm so grateful that since then I've always been supported by life. It's not like I'm living a very luxurious life. I have very few expenses, but still I'm always supported and I'm very, very, very grateful for that. And thank you for your answer.
You see, I'm reminded of someone I was deeply following in my younger days was the artist Salvador Dali. Mm-hmm. And I went when I was about, I don't remember now, late 20s, maybe early 30s. I was in Spain and I went to his home in Cadaqués, small village in Spain. And I saw this man was really a businessman because his studio was on the first floor. And he had a slit in the floor, maybe like 3 inches long slit. So whenever he would finish a big painting so that nobody had to carry it down, the truck would come below and with ropes, the painting was lowered straight onto the truck and out to be sold. In his later years, there was a big scandal because he started signing artworks of other artists as his, just for the money. And there are a lot of fake Salvador Dali prints where nobody knows who drew the painting and is it Dali's signature. So what happened in this case most likely is the greed for money. Now, maybe he had debts, maybe he didn't, I don't know all that. But that is when the balance is lost, you see. And yet, even that had to happen. One cannot blame him. But that is when the balance is lost, where the famous artist says, why bother now painting? All I need is to sign because that itself will get in the money. And thousands upon thousands, I believe there was a court case against him in those years. I don't know what happened. So balance. The relationship with money is what is very important to look at. And regarding Hindi, I would actually love to give a talk in Hindi, but my Hindi, unfortunately, my conditioning has been in a Jesuit school, which was English speaking. So it might be very broken Hindi and not Shuddh Hindi, but perhaps someone can help me in the translation if I say the wrong things, but I would more than love to give a Hindi satsang at some point. And in fact, Rishikesh is on the agenda. I don't know when this when things will open up, but I am looking forward to being in Rishikesh soon. All right. And even if you think you're charging too much and the money is coming, donate it to charity. That will mitigate the guilt. Then keep charging more and more and more so you can donate more and more and more and use only what you feel you need. Simple.
Thank you, sir.
You know, we had a translator of Nisargadatta Maharaj called Mullar Patan, who passed away. He passed away when he was in his mid-90s, I think. And his royalty from the sale of the books, one or two we published, at that time he had said, when I pass away, it should go to this hospice in Bangalore. And so every time his royalty payment goes there, they send a mail saying how grateful they are. And I told my staff, tell them they don't have to be grateful to us. We are doing our job. You know, it is Mullar Patan's royalty which is going to them. But they are grateful. Any charity or hospice which needs the money always appreciates it. Okay?
Thank you, sir.
I thought I had seen Vandana, but I can't see her. Yes, Indira.
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste.
How are you doing?
Good, good.
So I've been reading your book, Explosion of Love, and I'm just loving it. It's very beautiful.
Thank you.
I just wanted to express gratitude.
Thank you. You know, the funny thing with Explosion of Love is when I sent it to someone before it was published, you know, the very sweet girl, she did a design with all hearts and all that for the cover and like a romance novel.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, maybe you can use this for your cover. And I said, no, this is not the love which is being referred to. So obviously she had not read what was inside, but just gone with the title. And I think the teaching was not meant for her, but I'm reminded of that. But I enjoyed writing those essays very much.
Yes, even the drawings in between are very profound. I mean, most of it I couldn't understand, but yeah.
Are you referring to those three calligraphy drawings?
Yes, and the Phoenix drawing also is there in between.
Yes, that is by a very famous artist, and he actually was very kind to do those drawings. The calligraphy drawings. One is the heart, I think. One is the phoenix. And the third is the Ouroboros. Satish Gupta is his name. Can you show me? I've actually forgotten. Can you show us rather?
Yeah, this one, right? The phoenix.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? Can you hold that closer to the camera and I won't speak? You might have to say something.
No, I mean, it's beautiful. I can't put it into words.
Yeah.
There's something which resonates with this figure. Yeah, and I had an observation, but my ego just realized that it is not as profound. So there has been recent events where I've lost people. Very dear people to Corona. But when I hear the news, at first I don't, the grief doesn't set in, like, you know, because I haven't seen them or I have been at a distance with them. So when I hear the news that they're no more, I don't get the sadness or the grief immediately. And when I start thinking about it, that, oh, they're not there anymore, then the grief starts setting. So I was observing this and I feel that is there any teaching which is happening? That, you know, unless they're in our consciousness, they're really not dead. Like, so are they eternal? So that kind of thing is coming into.
Yes, that may be, but that does not mean that grief may not arise as soon as you hear the news about the passing. There's no correlation to that, because even the sage can shed tears if someone close passes away. That is important to understand. grief is a very natural reaction in the body. Now, whether that grief arises at the news of the passing or later is dependent on each body-mind organism and its conditioning. In your case, it could be that maybe earlier it arose immediately on the news of the death and now it doesn't. Because deep down, that realization is there. But yet, being human, the grief arises later.
Yeah, it does arise later.
Yeah.
But it's not very immediate.
Yeah, so in your case, that is what is happening. So it's actually a fallacy to think that for the enlightened sage, grief will not arise at all because he's enlightened. I don't think that's true. And even Bhagwan, there's a story when his close friend passed away, he shed a tear, you see. It's natural. It doesn't mean he didn't know that there's only the self.
Right. Even when Mahatma Gandhi had passed away, Bhagwan still shed tears.
Yeah, so that's it. What is written above you? There's some quotation and some butterflies I can see. Is there something profound or is it just some... No?
So my status is like what comes, let it come. What goes, let it go.
No, I can see up some leaves and some butterflies behind you and something.
Okay, that's a painting. That's a sticker poster I want.
No, but what is written?
Oh, that says life is beautiful.
Oh, okay. Well, we can't tell everyone that. Okay, Indira, thank you. Let's go to... I don't know if Vandana, you're there. I think you've disappeared, but I will take... Imran, are you there?
Yeah, sir. Namaskar, sir.
Namaste, hello.
Namaskar, everyone. I am Imran from Tripura, and this is my first Zoom meeting. And thank you so much for this beautiful opportunity. Sir, actually, I am always very grateful. Whatever is life is. Providing me all that ups and down. So in my doership, there is a question as because today I have got the opportunity to meet with you through Zoom. So I want to understand your insight. Already I have got some kind of answer from your YouTube channel, like some kind of podcast. So my question is on regarding money, as because I'm an entrepreneur, my doership question is this, sir. As because I am a, so since after post-COVID, my business actually got so much disturbance. So I'm in big debt, I could say, as a doership thought, that is financial disaster, I could say. But I know in your podcast of money, you said that whatever number is there, it is on consciousness only. This is right, actually. Then everything dissolves. So I use this insight that whatever is digit number, I feel lacking, I feel debt in market or in bank. This is just number. Throw everything on surrendering mode to God. I'll do my best, whatever opportunity will be given. Let's see what happened. So I take it easy. And thanks to Advaita teaching and different teacher like you in internet, in YouTube. So many so-called problem has been solved.
So what and is the
I
question?
Just, I'm saying that thank you for you, sir.
Oh, just thank you. Okay, Imran. But don't forget, you still have to pay your debts.
Yeah. Now, how to take it? I have so much debt. If I see that I am not the doership, everything happens for some reason. And I must say, because of this financial problem, I came into deep in Advaita teaching. earlier I was doing little bit of meditation, what about this in spiritual line, I have always have an interest, but because of this financial problem, I just depth in, I got engaged, yes, in Advaita teaching, and it helped me, yes, I think, and I said thank you to God
because, yes, of the financial problem. I think I'll just wrap this up because we are running out of time also, and we can continue, yeah, it next time. But you see, the point is, you are absolutely right that it is the suffering, and in your case, the financial stress as a result of COVID, which has affected so many people who have lost their jobs, that has made you delve deeper into the Advaita teachings. So in that sense, absolutely, you can see that everything has a reason. But in reality, you have debts. Debts have to be paid. And how, yes, you pay them depends on where you can find money to pay the debts from. These are very real situations. So the teaching comes in as a cushion, as you say, because you are at peace knowing that it was not, you didn't really do it. You didn't want to harm people. You didn't want to not pay bills, but you have found yourself in that situation. You see, that is where the teaching comes in. But now there are consequences for all our actions which have to be faced. And you have to face the consequences and do the best that you can do in the situation. That is it. So, I mean, I can really feel for you because all our businesses are down, and we can take this forward next time. But I'm really sorry for the situation.
Okay.
Because I have.
Yeah, I got the answer. No, I got the answer, sir.
Oh, you did?
I got the answer, sir. Yeah, I mean, you have already gave the answer in podcast regarding money in YouTube.
Yes.
And okay, my channel is Tag Max. I raised a question regarding this, and you sent me the link.
Okay.
And at that very time, I everything is a consciousness. And this is the main thing. I surrender everything. Do your best. Whatever coming, as a observer or just seeing and being like this.
Okay.
And thank you, sir.
Thank you. So my ideas, feel free to come on next Sunday. You're more than welcome.
Sure, sir.
I'll just change the view so I can see all of you all. For a couple of minutes, we can sit in silence. What's happened? Thank you. Namaste.